May we simply ask what would be the case if some people had really seen the fiery chariot that is described over and over again? A secret script was used very frequently in the Qumran scrolls. Among the documents in the fourth cave, different kinds of characters alternate in one and the same astrological work. An astronomical observation bears the title, Words of the Judicious One, which he has addressed to all sons of the dawn. But what is the crushing and convincing objection to the possibility that real fiery chariots were described in the ancient texts? Surely not the vague and stupid assertion that fiery chariots cannot have existed in antiquity. Such an answer would be unworthy of the men I am trying to force to face new alternatives with my questions. Lastly, it is by no means so long ago that reputable scholars said that no stones, equals meteors, could fall from the sky, because there are no stones in the sky. Even 19th century mathematicians came to the conclusion, convincing in their day, that a railway train would not be able to travel faster than 21 miles an hour, because if it did, the air would be forced out of it and the passengers would suffocate. Less than 100 years ago, it was proved that an object heavier than air would never be able to fly. A review in a reputable newspaper classed Walter Sullivan's book Signals from the Universe as science fiction and said that even in the more distant future it would be quite impossible to reach, say, Epsilon Eridani or Tau Ceti. Even the effect of a shift in time or deep freezing the astronauts could never overcome the barriers of the inconceivable distances. It is a good thing that there were always enough bold visionaries oblivious to contemporary criticism in the past. Without them, there would be no worldwide railway network today, with trains traveling at 124 miles an hour and over. NB passengers die at more than 21 miles per hour. Without them, there would be no jet aircraft today, because they would certainly fall to the ground. NB things that are heavier than air cannot fly, and lastly, there would be no moon rockets, because man cannot leave his own planet. There are so many, many things that would not exist but for the visionaries. A number of scholars would like to stick to the so-called realities. In so doing, they are too ready and willing to forget that what is reality today may have been the utopian dream of a visionary yesterday. We owe a considerable number of all the epoch-making discoveries that our age thinks of as realities to lucky chances, not to steady systematic research. And some of them stand to the credit of the serious visionaries who overcame restricting prejudice with their bold speculations. For example, Heinrich Schliemann accepted Homer's Odyssey as more than stories and fables and discovered Troy as a result. We still know too little about our past to be able to make a definitive judgment about it. New finds may solve unprecedented mysteries. The reading of ancient narratives is capable of turning whole worlds of realities upside down. Incidentally, it is obvious to me that more old books were destroyed than are preserved. There is supposed to have been a book in South America that contained all the wisdom of antiquity. It is reputed to have been destroyed by the 63rd Inca ruler Pachacuti IV. In the Library of Alexandria, 500,000 volumes belonging to the learned Ptolemy Soter contained all the traditions of mankind. The library was partly destroyed by the Romans, the rest was burnt on the orders of Caliph Omar centuries later. An incredible thought that invaluable and irreplaceable manuscripts were used to heat the public baths of Alexandria. What became of the library of the temple at Jerusalem? What became of the Library of Pergamon, which is supposed to have housed 200,000 works? When the Chinese Emperor Cai Huang ordered the destruction of a mass of historical, astronomical and philosophical books for political reasons in 214 BC, what treasures and secrets went with them? How many texts did the converted Paul have destroyed at Ephesus? And we cannot even imagine the enormous wealth of literature about all branches of knowledge that has been lost to us owing to religious fanaticism. How many thousands of irretrievable writings did monks and missionaries burn in South America in their blind religious zeal? That happened hundreds and thousands of years ago. Has mankind learned anything as a result? Only a few decades ago Hitler had books burnt in the public squares, and as recently as 1966 the same thing happened in China during Mao's kindergarten revolution. Thank heavens that today books do not exist in single copies, as in the past. The texts and fragments still available transmit a great deal of knowledge from the remote past. In all ages the sages of a nation knew that the future would always bring wars and revolutions, blood and fire. Did this knowledge perhaps lead these sages to hide secrets and traditions from the mob in the colossal buildings of their period, or to preserve them from possible destruction in a safer place? Have they hidden information or accounts in pyramids, temples or statues, or bequeathed them in the form of ciphers so that they would withstand the ravages of time? We certainly ought to test the idea, for far-seeing contemporaries of our own day have acted in this way, for the future. In 1965 the Americans buried two time capsules in the soil of New York so constituted that they could withstand the very worst that this earth can offer in the way of calamities for 5,000 years. These time capsules contained news that we want to transmit to posterity, so that someday those who strive to illuminate the darkness surrounding the past of their forefathers will know how we lived. The capsules are made of a metal that is harder than steel. They can even survive an atomic explosion. Apart from daily news, the capsules also contain photographs of cities, ships, automobiles, aircraft and rockets. They house samples of metals and plastics, of fabrics, threads and cloths. They hand down to posterity objects in everyday use such as coins, tools and toilet articles, books about mathematics, medicine, physics, biology and astronautics are preserved on microfilm. In order to complete this service for some remote and unknown future race, the capsules also contain a key, a book with the help of which all the written material can be translated into the languages of the future. A group of engineers from Westinghouse Electric had the idea of presenting the time capsules to posterity. John Harrington invented the ingenious decoding system for generations yet unknown. Lunatics? Visionaries? I find the realization of this project beneficial and reassuring. It's nice to know that there are men today who think 5,000 years ahead. The archaeologists of some remote future age will not find things any easier than we did. For after an atomic conflagration, none of the world's libraries will be of any use, and all the achievements that make us so proud will not be worth tuppence, because they have disappeared, because they have been destroyed, because they have been atomized. It does not even need an atomic conflagration to ravage the Earth to justify the New Yorker's imaginative action. A shifting of the Earth's axis by a few degrees would cause inundations on an unprecedented and irresistible scale. In any case, they would swallow up every single written word. Who is arrogant enough to assert that the sages of old could not have conceived the same sort of idea as the far-sighted New Yorkers? Undoubtedly the strategists of an A&H bomb war will not direct their weapons against Zulu villages and harmless Eskimos. They will use them against the centers of civilization. In other words, the radioactive chaos will fall on the advanced, most highly developed peoples. Savages and primitive peoples far away from the centers of civilization will be left. They will not be able to transmit our culture or even give an account of it, because they have never taken part in it. Even intelligent men and visionaries who had tried to preserve an underground library will not have been able to help the future much. Normal libraries will be destroyed in any case, and the surviving primitive peoples will know nothing of the hidden secret libraries. Whole regions of the globe will become burning deserts, because radiation lasting for centuries will not allow any plants to grow. The survivors will presumably be mutated, and after 2,000 years nothing will be left of the annihilated cities. There. Unbridled power of nature will eat its way through the ruins, iron and steel will rust and crumble into dust. And everything would begin again. Man may embark on his adventure a second or even a third time. Perhaps once again he would take so long to re-emerge as a civilized being that the secrets of old traditions and texts would be closed to him. 5,000 years after the catastrophe, archaeologists could claim that 20th century man was not yet familiar with iron, because, understandably enough, they would not find any, no matter how hard they dug. Along the Russian frontiers they would find miles of concrete tank traps, and they would explain that such finds undoubtedly indicated astronomical lines. If they were to find cassettes with tapes, they would not know what to do with them, they would not even be able to distinguish between played and unplayed tapes. And perhaps those tapes might hold the solution to many, many puzzles. Texts which spoke of gigantic cities with houses several hundred feet high would be poo-pooed, because such cities could not have existed. Scholars would take the London Tube tunnels for a geometrical curiosity or an astonishingly well-conceived drainage system. And they might keep on coming across reports which described how men flew from continent to continent with giant birds and referred to extraordinary fire-spitting ships which disappeared into the sky. That would also be dismissed as mythology, because such great birds and fire-spitting ships could not have existed. Things would be made very difficult for the translators in anno 7000. The facts about a world war in the 20th century that they would discover from fragmentary texts would sound quite incredible. But when the speeches of Marx and Lenin fell into their hands, they would at last be able to make two high priests of this incomprehensible age the center of a religion. What a piece of luck! People would be able to explain a great deal, provided sufficient clues were still in existence. 5,000 years is a long time. It is a pure caprice on nature's part that she allows dressed blocks of stone to survive for 5,000 years. She does not deal so carefully with the thickest iron girders. In the courtyard of a temple in Delhi there exists, as I have already mentioned, a column made of welded iron parts that has been exposed to weathering for more than 4,000 years without showing a trace of rust, for it contains neither sulfur nor phosphorus. Here we have an unknown alloy from antiquity staring us in the face. Perhaps the column was cast by a group of far-sighted engineers who did not have the resources for colossal building, but wanted to bequeath to posterity a visible, time-defying monument to their culture. It is an embarrassing story. In advanced cultures of the past we find buildings that we cannot copy today with the most modern technical means. These stone masses are there, they cannot be argued away. Because that which ought not to exist cannot exist, there is a frantic search for rational explanations. Let us take off our blinkers and join the search. Chapter 7, Ancient Marvels or Space Travel Centers? To the north of Damascus lies the Terrace of Baalbek, a platform built of stone blocks, some of which have sides over 65 feet long and weigh nearly 2,000 tons. Until now archaeologists have not been able to give a convincing explanation why, how and by whom the Terrace of Baalbek was built. However, the Russian professor Agrest considers it possible that the terrace is the remains of a gigantic airfield. If we meekly accept the neat package of knowledge that the Egyptologists serve to us, ancient Egypt appears suddenly and without transition with a fantastic ready-made civilization. Great cities and enormous temples, colossal statues with tremendous expressive power, splendid streets flanked by magnificent sculptures, perfect drainage systems, luxurious tombs carved out of the rock, pyramids of overwhelming size, these and many other wonderful things shot out of the ground, so to speak. Genuine miracles in a country that is suddenly capable of such achievements without recognizable prehistory. Fertile agricultural land only exists in the Nile Delta and on small strips to the left and right of the river. Yet experts now estimate the number of inhabitants at the time of the building of the Great Pyramid at 50 million. A figure, incidentally, that flagrantly contradicts the 20 million considered to be the total population of the world in 3000 BC. One of the maps found in the Topkapi Palace, Istanbul, in the library of Admiral Piri Reis early in the 18th century, it shows the Americas and West Africa Antarctica, mapped at the bottom, conforms very closely to the land mass under the ice, as revealed by echo sounding gear in recorded history. It has never been free of ice. Cartographers projected the pin race map onto a grid using the reference points shown on the map. It then appeared virtually identical with this United States Air Force map of the world on an equidistant projection based on Cairo. The Earth taken from Apollo 8 shows close similarity to the Piri race map. The curious elongated shape of the Americas is particularly striking. On the plain of Nazca in Peru appear these strange markings. A view of the plain showing that the markings, Inca roads, say the archaeologists, lead nowhere. The markings in greater detail. Another of the strange markings on the plain of Nazca. This is very reminiscent of the aircraft parking bays on a modern airport. This huge 820-foot figure above the Bay of Pisco points to the plain of Nazca. Could this be an aerial direction indicator rather than a symbol of religious significance? This is the ancient Mayan temple of the inscriptions at Palenque in Mexico. Inside on the wall of one of the small chambers is this relief engraving. There is not enough space to take a full front view photograph, but there is enough detail to check the artist's drawing reproduced on the next page. This drawing was made in the temple. Could primitive imagination have produced anything so remarkably similar to a modern astronaut in his rocket? Those strange markings at the foot of the drawing can only be an indication of the flames and gases coming from the propulsion unit. American astronauts today take up the same position, their hands on controls, their eyes checking instruments. On July 21st Street, 1969, a London bookmaker paid out £10,000. Only 5 years earlier, he gave odds of 1,000 to 1 that man would not land on the moon before 1970. A fortnight later, the Americans released photographs taken 2,000 miles away from Mars. Space travel had moved out of the realms of science fiction. After centuries under the sea, this object does not look very important. It was found by Greek divers off Antikythera in 1900 above. Right, long and patient cleaning revealed that it was a mass of interlocking cogs and was a planetarium. The machine gives the year of construction as 82 BC. This drawing reconstructs part of the machine. Easter Island is known as the navel of the world by the islanders. The huge statues on this tiny fragment of rock are extraordinary. Even more extraordinary is the fact that this totally isolated island had its own script, which is still undeciphered. This ancient iron pillar does not rust. It cannot be accurately dated, but it is hundreds of years old. This Babylonian tablet records past and future eclipses. Here are three curious things from Assyria and one from Iraq. The god Shamash. It is from the 3rd millennium BC and shows stars and figures with peculiar headgear. Why should ancient gods be associated with the stars? The second tablet is from the early 1st millennium BC. The object in the center is described as a sacred tree. It could just as reasonably be interpreted as a symbolic representation of the construction of an atom. With an astronaut in a fiery chariot above, we have a figure within a winged circle, and below the circle a representation. Next we have an Assyrian crystal lens from the 7th century BC. To grind such a lens requires a highly sophisticated mathematical formula. Where did the Assyrians get such knowledge? Finally, these very ancient fragments, now in the Baghdad Museum, have been identified as the remains of an electric battery. The next five photographs are from South America, a continent teeming with ruins and unexplained puzzles. This is part of a huge monolithic block weighing an estimated 20,000 tons. It can be found at Sacsayhuaman in Peru. What was its purpose? What titanic forces turned it upside down? And what did these great steps lead to? A throne for giants, perhaps? Rock vitrification requires very high temperatures. What caused it in Peru? Part of the huge terrace walls at Sacsayhuaman. Just look at the incredible accuracy of the jointing. How could primitive people handle these huge blocks? A mummy from the 2nd dynasty. Part of a very finely woven piece of cloth. Where did the Egyptians get such complex techniques so early? With wood rollers and manpower, it would have taken at least 600 years to handle the 2.5 million stone blocks in the Great Pyramid of Cheops. As in Peru, We are faced with fantastically accurate jointing of huge blocks of stone. This temple at Copan in Honduras is constructed according to the Mayan calendar with a fixed number of steps completed every 52 years. There is no recorded history of Tiahuanaco on the Gate of the Sun. Above, carved out of a single 10-ton block, is the representation of a flying god flanked by 48 mysterious figures. Legend tells of a golden spaceship which came from the stars. On the Great Idol, is found information about astronomical phenomena covering an immense span of time. Once again, what primitive people had techniques for handling and accurately jointing such huge blocks of stone, in this case water conduits 6 feet long and 1.5 foot. El Castillo at Chichen Itza, Mexico. This also has been constructed according to the Mayan calendar. The 91 steps on each side add up to 364 and the final platform gives 365. In Bolivia near Santa Cruz are long concrete constructions. Could these really be roads for people who did not use the wheel? Rock drawings from all round the world. Left, from Rhodesia. This reclining figure is clad in chainmail and wears curious headgear. It might be the burial of a king. It might just as likely be an astronaut receiving supplies. Right, this drawing from South Africa shows a white figure dressed in a short-sleeved suit with breeches, garters, gloves and slippers, a rather surprising example of imagination on the part of primitive natives who went about naked. This drawing was found by a Russian expedition. This drawing from Valcamonica in northern Italy shows yet again the extraordinary obsession primitive man had with figures and suits and unusual headgear. More ancient drawings. From Navoi. From Fergana in Uzbekistan. From Tassili in the Sahara. An American astronaut, perhaps the earliest space travelers, also wore suits like this. With such enormous estimates, a couple of million men more or less does not matter. But one thing is clear, they all had to be fed. There were not only a host of construction workers, stonemasons, engineers and sailors, there were not only hundreds of thousands of slaves, but also a well-equipped army, a large and pampered priesthood, countless merchants, farmers and officials, and last but not least the faraonic household living on the fat of the land. Could they all who've lived on the scanty yields of agriculture in the Nile Delta? I shall be told that the stone blocks used for building the temple were moved on rollers. In other words, wooden rollers. But the Egyptians would scarcely have felled and turned into rollers the few trees, mainly palms, that then, as now, grew in Egypt, because the dates from the palms were urgently needed for food and the trunks and fronds were the only tilings giving shade to the dried up ground. But they must have been wooden rollers, otherwise there would not be even the feeblest technical explanation of the building of the pyramids. Did the Egyptians import wood? In order to import wood there must have been a sizable fleet. And even after it had been landed in Alexandria, the wood would have had to be transported up the Nile to Cairo. Since the Egyptians did not have horses and carts at the time of the building of the Great Pyramid, there was no other possibility. The horse and cart was not introduced until the 17th dynasty, about 1600 BC. My kingdom for a convincing explanation of the transport of the stone blocks. Of course, the scholars say that wooden rollers were needed. There are many problems connected with the technology of the pyramid builders and no genuine solutions. How did the Egyptians carve tombs out of the rock? What resources did they have in order to lay out a maze of galleries and rooms? The walls are smooth and mostly decorated with paintings in relief. The shafts slope down into the rocky soil. They have steps built in the best tradition of craftsmanship that lead to the burial chambers far below. Hordes of tourists stand gaping in amazement at them, but none of them gets an explanation of the mysterious technique used in their excavation. Yet it is firmly established that the Egyptians were masters of the art of tunneling from the earliest times, for the old rock-cut tombs are worked in exactly the same way as the more recent ones. There is no difference between the tomb of Teti from the 6th dynasty and the tomb of Ramesses I from the New Kingdom, although there is a minimum of 1,000 years between the building of the two tombs. Obviously, the Egyptians had not learned anything new to add to their old technique. In fact, the more recent edifices tend increasingly to be poor copies of their ancient models. The tourist who bumps his way to the Pyramid of Cheops to the west of Cairo on a camel called Wellington or Napoleon, depending on his nationality, gets the strange sensation in the pit of his stomach that relics of the mysterious past always produce. The guide tells him that one pharaoh had a burial place built here. And with that bit of rehashed tradition, he rides homewards, after taking some impressive photographs. The Pyramid of Cheops, in particular, has inspired hundreds of crazy and untenable theories. In the 600-page long book Our Inheritance in the Great Pyramid by Charles Piercy Smith, published in 1864, we can read about many hair-raising links between the pyramid and our globe, yet even after a highly critical examination, it still contains some facts that should stimulate us to reflection. It is well known that the ancient Egyptians practiced a solar religion. Their sun god, Ra, traveled through the heavens in a bark. Pyramid texts of the Old Kingdom even describe heavenly journeys by the king, obviously made with the help of the gods and their boats. So the gods and kings of the Egyptians were also involved with flying. Is it really a coincidence that the height of the Pyramid of Cheops multiplied by 1,000 million corresponds approximately to the distance between the Earth and Sun? That is to say, 93 million miles. Is it a coincidence that a meridian running through the pyramid divides continents and oceans into two exactly equal halves? Is it coincidence that the area of the base of the pyramid divided by twice its height gives the celebrated figure, pi, equals 3.14159, discovered by Ludolf? Is it coincidence that calculations of the weight of the Earth were found, and is it also coincidence that the rocky ground on which the structure stands is carefully and accurately leveled? There is not a single clue to explain why the builder of the Pyramid of Cheops, the pharaoh Khufu, chose that particular rocky terrain in the desert as the site for his edifice. It is conceivable that there was a natural cleft in the rock which he made use of for the colossal building, while another explanation, though only a feeble one, may be that he wanted to watch the progress of the work from his summer palace. Both reasons are against all common sense. In the first case, it would certainly have been more practical to locate the building site nearer the eastern quarries in order to shorten transport distances. And in the second, it is hard to imagine that the pharaoh wanted to be disturbed year after year by the din that filled building sites day and night even in those days, since there is so much to be said against the textbook explanations of the choice of site. One might reasonably ask whether the gods did not have their say here, too, even if it was by way of the priesthood. But if that explanation is accepted, there is one more important proof of my theory of the utopian past of mankind. For the pyramid not only divides continents and oceans into two equal halves, but also lies at the center of gravity of the continents. If the facts noted here are not coincidences, and it seems extremely difficult to believe that they are, then the building site was chosen by beings who knew all about the spherical shape of the Earth and the distribution of continents and seas. In this connection, let us not forget Piri Reis's maps. It cannot all be coincidence or be explained away as fairy stones. With what power, with what machines, with what technical resources was the rocky terrain leveled at all? How did the master builders drive the tunnels downwards? And how did they illuminate them? Neither here nor in the rock-cut tombs in the Valley of Kings were torches or anything similar used. There are no blackened ceilings or walls or even the slightest evidence that traces of blackening have been removed. How and with what were the stone blocks cut out of the quarries? With sharp edges and smooth sides? How were they transported and joined together to the thousandth of an inch? Once again, there is a wealth of explanations for anyone to choose from: inclined planes, and tracks along which the stones were pushed, scaffolding and ramps. And naturally the labor of many hundreds of thousands of Egyptian slaves, fellahin, builders and craftsmen. None of these explanations stands up to a critical examination. The Great Pyramid is, and remains, visible testimony of a technique that has never been understood. Today, in the 20th century, no architect could build a copy of the Pyramid of Cheops, even if the technical resources of every continent were at his disposal.